I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It is 50 years ago this spring that Lyndon Johnson escalated the war in Vietnam with ground troops. 40 years since Gerald Ford presided over a chaotic flight of the last Americans out of Saigon. There's not much controversy left around what happened in Vietnam. A grinding victory of poor peasant nationalists and communists over the bombs, chemicals, and ground forces of the United States. What's interesting is that the story still feels somehow unacceptable and in many ways unfinished. So what's the moral here? That was the question the bewildered troops kept asking in the immortal Vietnam testimony, The Things They Carried, by the writer Tim O'Brien, who fought in the war against his better judgment. So we're asking his question again with some tenacious explorers. The investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, who broke the first awful news of the American massacre at My Lai in 1969, and then went back last winter to the scene of the crime. Also, Noam Chomsky, the radical critic of American military power from the early 60s to today. We'll begin with the historian Christian Appy, who has a new account of what we learned about ourselves, American Reckoning, in his title. But first, on a 20-year war under five American presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, here is a sampling of those five voices of wavering authority on what they said was at stake.
You have broader considerations that might follow what you would call the falling domino principle.
If we withdrew from Vietnam, pretty soon Thailand, Cambodia, Laos would go, and all of Southeast Asia would be under the control of the communists and under the domination of the Chinese. So I think we should stay. We should make it clear that while we want to help, we don't see a successful ending to this war unless the people will support it.
I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing. The more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like we're getting into another Korea. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
I know there are those who honestly believe that I should move to end this war without regard to what happens to South Vietnam. This way would abandon our friends, but even more important, we would abandon ourselves.
We will honor our commitments, and we will uphold our country's principles.
Christian Appy, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts, has drilled deep into the Vietnam story in search of American identity, especially our belief that there's never been a country or a people quite like us. American Reckoning, out this spring, is his account of a fall from grace in Vietnam. I'm asking him, after hearing those presidential clips, what our American leadership really knew and didn't know about Vietnam.
The main thing that I think brings all of these five presidents together, if I could sort of summarize it in the most simple terms, is that none of them was going to be the first president in United States history to lose a war. All of them deeply remembered 1949, when communists came to power in China, and the great political outcry was, who lost China? Now, of course, China was not ours to lose, and it's unlikely that we ever could have done anything to prevent it. But because it happened on Truman's watch, the Republicans really successfully tarred him and his administration with falling down on the job. And ever since, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, they all deeply internalized that sense that their own personal as well as our national credibility depended on sticking with our commitments and not losing. Or when things went bad, at least trying to find a way to exit it that saved some measure of face.
Who said this? In 1954, the time has come for the American people to be told the blunt truth about Indochina, to pour money, materiel, and men into the jungles of Indochina without at least a remote prospect of victory would be dangerously futile and self-destructive. That's John F. Kennedy.
That's right. That was Senator Kennedy. And he, like a lot of Americans in the public and in Congress, were resistant to any thought that we should go in to Indochina to help bail out the French in the last days of their collapse. So while we were paying at that point almost 80% of their war, we were not willing, and Eisenhower understood he didn't have the support for this, we were not willing to send in direct military, soldiers and our bombers to try to bail them out. The mystery of it, of course, is then why would these same people, including Kennedy, you know, who had a very savvy critique of the French fortunes in a country where they were so profoundly opposed, why would we repeat the same mistake? And at least part of the answer is Americans then and for a long time before it never saw themselves as an imperial power, that our intentions were pure, our motives were selfless. But the Vietnamese, by and large, saw right through it. They had a word for it. They said, this is neocolonialism. It's just ruling indirectly or by proxy. So from the early days, the writing really was on the wall in terms of the sort of obvious evidence that the government that we were supporting in the South never had the broad support of its own people.
I was wide awake and watching at the time. I still can't remember what I thought was driving us. It wasn't oil. It wasn't high tech. It wasn't, you know, a digital contraction of the whole single planet into
you're right, Chris. It wasn't any single product or resource. But I do think that there is an economic underpinning to our intervention there, not because of any particular thing that we valued in Vietnam itself, but we were already thinking in global economic terms. Mm. And those economic concerns were completely intersected and almost indistinguishable from the political and ideological concerns about communism. Anti-communism is, in the American context, is also to be pro free markets, as they would say, free enterprise, pro-capitalism. The fear, of course, and Eisenhower articulated this, he's really famously came up with the domino theory, and he believed it, that if one country should fall to communism, the neighbor was likely to fall, and the neighbor after that, and eventually we would find ourselves in a world where we're falling behind and losing the Cold War, and losing not just ideologically or strategically, but losing economically.
Looking back, you realize it was a field day for a certain kind of social engineering, social science. Walt Ross has precise theories of the stages of economic development. We were going to turn these rice paddies into another model of urban small manufacturing, small business, or something. Who gave them the authorization to sort of remake the world? Why did we feel entitled?
Well, people like Walt Rostow really did have this vision of American exceptionalism, greatest country on earth, always on the side of freedom and democracy, and particularly his devotion to modernization, as he understood it, he thought it was the wave of the future. His famous book, The Stages of Economic Growth, had the subtitle, A Non-Communist Manifesto, and he explicitly intended it to be an answer to and a critique of the Communist Manifesto, and that modernization would be the antidote to communism. It would show them an alternative route into modernity, that if people could just get on that track, and he really did see it as a kind of mechanistic, inevitable unfolding of stages from kind of traditional economies to this period of takeoff, he called it, to this final stage of the era of mass consumption, I think he called it. This is the crazy part in my mind. This is a prescription that he arrogantly believed, and he certainly wasn't alone, that would work for everybody. If it worked in Peru, it would work in Vietnam. Therefore, you really didn't have to know anything about the culture or politics of any particular place. That local knowledge was irrelevant because he had this kind of abstract commitment to this view of historical change, and that they thought they could just kind of put in this template and it would work. And when it didn't work, they would force the issue by driving people out of the countryside into the cities. This was an explicit part of American military policy to put people on trucks and helicopters, drive them out of their villages, burn down their villages, move them into refugee camps or make them fend for themselves in the cities or these shanty towns outside of American bases. But this was not thought as a bad thing, as a war crime. They actually talked about generating refugees, at least internal refugees. They had that as a metric of success right there, just below body count.
You know, it would be comical if it weren't literally insane. But the strange part is it persisted even into our invasion of Iraq. Between the lines of the whole thing was, we have a kit. It's called democracy, and we'll just unpack it like a Boy Scout manual. Here's how you do it.
Right, though, but it wasn't even that organized.
We'll bomb you.
Yeah, we'll bomb you into modernity. I mean, it's a funny twist on the line attributed to Air Force General Curtis LeMay, who once said that we should bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age. People like Samuel Huntington at Harvard believed we should bomb them into modernity. And his reasoning is, if you bomb them in the countryside, that forces them into the city where they will find new opportunities, a market economy, consumer goods, part of the whole sort of economic takeoff.
You speak of the, you call them paper tigers, intellectuals, a lot of them centered and rooted at Harvard, who were egging on the notion, giving it a structural framework. But one of the supreme ones was McGeorge Bundy, who was JFK's security chief and advisor, the best dean Harvard ever had, the model of the best and brightest. The funny part that you reveal very clearly again is that he didn't believe in victory. He didn't think it was possible. He kept trying to summon a clear statement to LBJ that this thing was not going to work. But we had to do it anyway.
Right. It's quite appalling. At least in the 50s, Eisenhower and on into Kennedy, I do believe, thought that stopping communism was important in some basic way to global security, including our own. But by the mid-60s, many of these advisors, and George Bundy is the classic example, no longer really believed that our security was in any way threatened in Vietnam. But what he was worried about was that if we were to withdraw, or at least try to show that we're willing to lose lives and make a big military commitment, that we would be perceived as paper tigers by the rest of the world, not just the communist world, but by our allies and our own people, that this whole idea of credibility was at stake, that we had to demonstrate, even if it doesn't work. And that's these memos that he wrote to LBJ, when you read them, are just astonishing, because he will say things like, I'm recommending the daily systematic bombing of North Vietnam, but I can't assure you that it will work. It may fail. It may very well fail. The odds may be 25% to 75%. But even if it fails, it's worth it, because it will demonstrate to the world. Like a good doctor, we will show that we've done everything possible to save the patient of South Vietnam. But of course, he's not talking about medicine. He's talking about advocating mass killing to prove a point and preserve a reputation and to avoid what one of McNamara's aides said, that one reason we stay in Vietnam, never mind why we got in here, the one reason why we need to stay is, quote unquote, to avoid humiliation.
That was Christian Appy, historian of the Vietnam War and American identity. We'll have more of him coming up. Among the last of the legendary reporters on Vietnam, Seymour Hersh. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Vietnam was an epic season in American journalism. The classic pattern was set by notably well-schooled young American men who went out after college on a dangerous assignment in Vietnam, in a spirit of adventure. Much sooner, though, than the military brass or the politicians, reporters like Neil Sheehan of the UPI, New Zealander Peter Arnett of the Associated Press, and David Halberstam of the New York Times saw and insisted on writing that the war was a bad project heading toward hell. And then they became an issue.
We were faced with the problem of covering a war where the advisors in the field were telling us we were losing the war. And that's what we could also see when we went out in operations, which is pretty frequent. The general in Saigon saw the world through rose-colored glasses and kept seeing it through them. He would maintain we were winning the war. You were caught between the two. It was an adversarial relationship.
Now, we know from the Pentagon Papers that what they said publicly was not an accurate reflection of what they knew. But their version was that, look, we've got to win this thing. We've got to get public support. The press should be behind us.
I did not have any idea how tough it was going to be, that, in effect, the reporters were going to be politically an endangered or jeopardized species, and that we were going to confront a vast lying machine which would very quickly sort of target us as the enemy, that it suppressed all other elements of dissent.
Our guest, Seymour Hersh, known as Cy, was a different story. He was a Lone Ranger just out of the University of Chicago who in 1968 started hearing horror stories from returned soldiers about a U.S. Army massacre of civilians in a village called My Lai. It's established now that My Lai was a standard operation, one of hundreds, but it was a shock in 1969 when the story showed up in the New York Times and then everywhere. Cy Hersh went back to My Lai for the New Yorker magazine last winter to learn more of the Vietnamese perspective.
I didn't want to go back for a lot of reasons. One of them being, how long can I brush snow off my mantle, you know, on top of Mount Olympus, about how wonderful I am? I don't like that. And secondly, I didn't want to face that horrible thing that these kids did. I mean, look, as awful as the stories were, some of the mutilation of women I'm not getting into. They went crazy. Yes, and on the other hand, they were poorly trained. They had no idea what they were doing. The officers were terrible. The leadership was terrible. And it was a unit that was so badly out of control. This Charlie Company, Lieutenant Kelly's group that went in. I went back and reread a lot of the testimony, and the Army did an elaborate, expansive investigation. And the thing that was the most shocking, there was testimony that this group, even after doing the horrible stuff they did at My Lai, an officer who came upon this Charlie Company later, said that they were so out of control, they were dirty, they would go on missions, and they would dig up graves of Vietnamese looking for trinkets and stuff they could sell. Just after the event. And so you say to yourself, it's a snapshot of hell. Nobody was monitoring what these kids are doing. We just went in there, and nobody liked us, and we went in there and just murdered away. There was no differentiation between soldier and civilian. Even the women and kids, they were Viet Cong sympathizers. That was the phrase we used for the enemy. It's an amazing sort of sad, dreary story about America going into some place where we knew nothing and came out learning not much.
The Vietnamese have been living with this horror story from the other side. What are the stories they tell you?
The most interesting thing for me was to see there's a wonderful woman who was the leader of the National Liberation Front, the actual guerrilla group that was fighting with the North against the South. We called her Madame Bin, a very attractive woman, early 40s. She was a striking, beautiful woman. They would cheer her when they saw her on the streets. You know, as she walked around Paris, she would be cheered. She was just so revered for standing up to the Americans. She was very tough in the talks. And in interviews with me for the time, she would go after Kissinger. And those are the days you could actually get that stuff in the paper. And so I found her. She's in her 80s. She still writes. She writes columns. She had been vice president of the country, but she hadn't been in politics for 10 years. And we've talked about a lot of stuff. She pretends to remember me, but I'm not sure she did. And I said, well, let's talk about My Lai. That's what I'm here to talk about. And I was sitting next to her, and she reached out this grandmotherly way. And she puts her hand over mine. She says, oh, Seymour, she said, the only reason My Lai was important was because it was written by an American. And her message was, there are many My Lais, she said. And I thought to myself, I couldn't write this because it's what I thought. But my thought was, oh, my God, she's as tough as ever. She's saying to me, yes, I'm glad you wrote the story. Yes, I'm glad there was an anti-war movement in America. And I'm glad that your story did so much of what you did to fuel the anti-war movement. That's all I really did. The anti-war movement was really more powerful than anything else. That's what made Nixon stop, not My Lai. Everybody says it did, but it was the anti-war movement. But her message was to me, listen, we beat you. We didn't do it because of the anti-war movement. We're the ones that stood and dug holes and lived on. We got pounded by B-52 bombs, and when the bombing was over, we climbed out and killed your boys. That's what won the war. We stuck it out. And that was the message to me. And that was really interesting to hear. You got to know who you fight against. We picked the wrong fight.
You took your wife and daughters to Vietnam this time. What did they learn?
A daughter and two grown sons. We all learned a lot. First of all, Vietnam, in a way, it's put it behind it. You know, America is now a major tourist base for the Vietnamese, and it's a beautiful country to visit, and they do enormous business with Americans. It's become this flourishing Chinese-style corrupt communist leadership and a flourishing country, despite it all, despite the corruption at the top. So you got to see the people, and you got to see that maybe 80% of the people were born after the war. They put it behind them. But we also got a chance. There was a man, a director of the museum, and I did a long interview. His name was Mr. Kong. And we got a chance to see his anger. I got a chance to see his anger. Yes, everybody turned the other way, but you can't be a survivor of what happened and have three siblings and a mother and an uncle die in the same little hut where the Americans just raced in and threw grenades and fired bullets. He got three wounds, but he survived. I guess they assumed he was dead. He was 11 years old. Can you imagine the trauma? But I got him to get beyond that in a way. I wasn't provoking him to do it. He just got beyond that. And he talked a little bit about the anger. And there isn't much forgiveness. If you were at My Lai and you want to come and say you're sorry, he'll accept it. But if you want to come, as one soldier did, and say, I don't remember what happened, you're in trouble. And it was good to see. We have been splashing our wonderful goodwill that really did exist. We've been splashing it pretty heavily. I think Gitmo, Guantanamo, has done more than even Milai to diminish our goodwill. But it's all the same story, in a way.
On the 40th anniversary of our departure, Cy, three levels of the tragedy.
Well,
what's the lesson here?
What we should know now is that there's no learning curve in America. Wrong war, wrong time, sending American boys overseas to fight in a foreign nation for reasons unclear, lack of information about the real geopolitics of the area and the time. Here we are, a little bit later in another decade. Now we're in Iraq fighting a war in a culture we don't know for facts that aren't so clear to most people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Afghanistan, Yemen, you name it. Wherever it is, we're there. Without sounding arrogant, for the press, it's important to read before you write. You got to know the history. You got to know the culture. We don't do that. The number of people in our community now that are very good at some of the languages are in the intelligence community are dwindling. Our CIA is not nearly as effective as it once was. What can I say to you? We have to change the way we operate, but we're not going to. We're still a great country. How can I knock our country? I came from immigrants. I didn't have to pay to go to college. I graduated from the University of Chicago in 58, and 11 years later, here I am, this kid from Chicago whose parents were born in Russia and Poland and wherever. I'm sticking two fingers into the eye of a Republican president named Nixon and giving him a real problem, and I'm winning prizes for it. I'm not going to knock America. There's no place like it.
That was Seymour Hersh, long of the New York Times and then the New Yorker magazine. With the historian Christian Appy, I'm reminded that by 1970, there was a pre-revolutionary air in many American cities, anger about Vietnam compounded by the U.S. invasion of Cambodia, the killing of protesters on the Kent State campus in Ohio, the trial in New Haven of the Black Panther Bobby Seale. John Lindsay, the dashing liberal mayor of New York, said, "The country is virtually on the edge of a spiritual, perhaps even physical, breakdown. For the first time in a century," he said, "we are not sure there is a future for America."
Yeah, it really did feel in those days like the country was coming apart at the seams, and that there had been this profound political awakening that, at least for millions of Americans, involved a fundamental rethinking and challenge to every form of received wisdom and every kind of authority. And at the heart of it is this deep questioning of that faith in American exceptionalism that had been with us going all the way back to the beginnings of our history, but in my mind really was at its heyday in World War II and the 15 or so years after that. And that whole generation of the so-called the baby boomers and the Vietnam generation grew up at a time when that faith was so fervent that when evidence surfaced, really starting with the civil rights movement, when you turned on the TV and saw civil rights demonstrators being fire-hosed in the streets or bitten by German Shepherd police dogs, those questions immediately arise. That's not what we learned in our high school textbooks about democracy and freedom. And then when you began to see South Vietnamese villages being burned down and indiscriminate bombing and the My Lai massacre revelation and National Guards troops firing on our own nonviolent protesting students and killing four and wounding nine others, and then two more students being killed at Jackson State, and three more people being killed out in L.A. during the Chicano anti-war moratorium. These kinds of events just piled up and had a kind of a critical weight. At a time, more maybe than at any other time in our history, people are making these connections between the wrong we're doing abroad and the injustice that still remains at home. And the reason that Martin Luther King and people like Robert Kennedy so galvanized this oppositional energy is that they could make those connections between the issues we still need to address at home around race and economic inequality and our willingness to pursue a protracted war against peasants 10,000 miles away.
The doubts went very, very deep, but I'm wondering now, we were learning something, but we were not learning something.
Well, while many Americans were radicalized by the experience of the Vietnam War, many others were digging in their heels and saw the failures of that war as indicating a deeper failure in the American spirit. And from their point of view, the protests of the 60s represented a softening and a weakening of American patriotism and the American spirit. And so their project, which really in the post-Vietnam decades becomes quite successful, is really try to return to what they perceived as a better America, where you had that unity and you had that commitment to international strength and pride. And that really became the Reagan project of the 1980s. A part of that project, of course, required the repackaging of the Vietnam War. Some of it's just sort of forgetting the bad stuff and trying to put a positive light on American service, focusing on veterans as heroic servants of the United States. And then also Reagan was helped by even a sort of a liberal tendency in those years to think more about the war as an American tragedy, rather than to rehash what we had done, all the devastation we had brought to Vietnam and all the death, the killing of 3 million people compared to our 58,000. We were, in effect, kind of licking our own wounds. And there was a lot of talk in the culture at the time about healing and coming back together and ending our divisions. And we did it around things like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and this sort of sense of national shame. I've had students over the years that I think really grew up believing that the most shameful thing about the Vietnam War had nothing to do with what we did in Vietnam, but how we had mistreated our own veterans when they returned to this country. So this serves really to sort of marginalize much of this very important and devastating history.
We still know almost nothing about the vast and maybe eternal damage that defoliation, Agent Orange chemicals did to the land. We knew nothing about Vietnam. And I mean the presidents, the generals, the secretaries of state knew almost nothing of their language, their culture, their desires. They were left out of the conversation almost entirely and are to this day, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, going all the way back to 1945, at the end of World War II, Ho Chi Minh wrote seven letters to President Truman, essentially begging him to acknowledge Vietnamese independence and not allow the French to come back in and reconquer that colony. Those were completely ignored. When we turn him down, he increasingly moves in that camp. Of course, he had been a communist since 1930, but he was always a very shrewd and pragmatic, and nationalistic communist. Who knows how Vietnam might have evolved had we recognized his independence? The best guess, I think, is that it would have become a kind of Yugoslavia, independent communist nation, as Yugoslavia had been under Tito. But these things are unknowable because you can't really replay history. In any case, you're right, we didn't know anything about this longer history, about the fact that Vietnam really was a nation struggling for nationhood going back for 2,000 years, that it had fought for more than 1,000 years to try to drive out the Chinese, and then after that the Mongols, and then the Chinese came back in and they drove them out again, and then the French came. So this is really deep in their roots. I mean, every Vietnamese child learns to honor those Vietnamese who were not collaborators with the enemy, but were the rebels. Those were the great Vietnamese patriots and heroes. So yes, we ignored all of that because in that Cold War mindset, there was the assumption that revolutionary movements developing indigenously in small third world countries were inevitably dependent upon this larger communist apparatus that could be controlled and manipulated at the center, meaning the Kremlin. And over time, that kind of thinking shifted. I do think by the mid-60s, policymakers were skeptical of that monolithic view of communism. But that returns us to that point about, well, why stay in? Well, we don't want to lose. Our credibility is on the line.
Christian Appy's American Reckoning comes 40 years after the war. In the thick of it, from the mid-60s onward, Noam Chomsky at MIT, founder of the modern science of linguistics, was challenging every premise of the war in Vietnam. He argued that beyond arrogant, it was morally wrong, even before it became clear the war wasn't working. His television bouts with the flamboyant conservative William F. Buckley stand up on YouTube as public debate of a high order. Here's a taste of Buckley's PBS firing line almost 50 years ago.
I rejoice in your disposition to argue the Vietnam question, especially when I recognize what an act of self-control this must involve.
It does.
Sure.
It really does.
Sure.
I mean, I think that this is the kind of issue where...
You're doing very well.
Sometimes I lose my temper. Maybe not tonight.
Maybe not tonight. because if you would, I'd smash you in the goddamn face. you say in your book...
Good reason for not losing
my You say the war is simply an obscenity, a depraved act by weak and miserable men.
Including all of us. Including myself.
Well,
including
then,
every... That's the next sentence. Same sentence.
Sure. Because you count everybody in the company of the guilty.
I think that's true in this case.
But
one of the points I was
trying...
This
is a sense of theological observation, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Because as somebody points out, if everybody's guilty of everything, then nobody's guilty of anything.
No, I don't believe that. See, I think that... I think the point that I'm trying to make, and I think ought to be made, is that the real, in a sense, terrifying aspect of our society and other societies is the equanimity and the detachment with which sane, reasonable, sensible people can observe such events. I think that's more terrifying than the occasional Hitler or LeMay or other that crops up. These people would not be able to operate were it not for this apathy and equanimity.
Coming up, Noam Chomsky, this week, looking back on a constructed history of good intentions. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Noam Chomsky was always different from the mass of Vietnam War critics. They banged away at the strategic blunders and the tactical excesses. He was morally suspicious of the very idea of military assault and enforced modernization of a poor peasant country a world away. And he blamed liberal social scientists of his own class for inventing that bad idea before the war tried to enact it. Noam Chomsky, at 86, keeps showing up in polls as the most respected public intellectual in the world. I've always thought of him as the American version of Socrates, asking impossibly direct, usually embarrassing questions in the public square. He spoke with us at length this week in Cambridge.
Take the end of the war, 1975. At the end of the war, there were, of course, many articles, reflections, analyses, what it all mean, and they're pretty interesting. You couldn't find a critic more harsh than Anthony Lewis of the New York Times. Strong civil libertarian, fighting liberal, sharp critic of the war. Take a look at what he wrote. It's very enlightening. He said, "The war began with blundering efforts to do good. Why? Well, we did it, so it was obviously to do good. It's an axiom of intellectual culture. If we do it, it's to do good. Blundering because it didn't work." And by 1969, he said it was clear that it was a disaster and we could not introduce into South Vietnam a government of the kind that we wanted at a cost acceptable to ourselves. So it was therefore a disaster. That's like a Russian commentator in the early 80s saying, look, the invasion of Afghanistan began with blundering efforts to do good, but a couple of years later it turned out to be a disaster. We couldn't achieve what we wanted at a cost acceptable to ourselves. How would we react to that? We would think the guy's a moral monster. But when we do it, we regard it as heroism. And it's exactly the same with Iraq. Many changes over the years, but take the commentary on Iraq. Obama is considered a moral hero because he said it's a strategic blunder, that we shouldn't do stupid things. Yeah, that's like the Russian generals who were opposed to the war in Afghanistan, strategic blunder. Is it wrong? I mean, is there anything wrong with carrying out aggression, the supreme international crime, invading another country on no pretext, killing hundreds of thousands of people, creating millions of refugees, destroying the place that may never recover, inciting sectarian conflicts that didn't exist, that are now tearing the country and the region apart. Could there be something wrong with that? Not if we did it. The most extreme criticism that can be made in polite circles is a mistake. You know, incidentally, the popular reaction after the war was interesting. The Chicago Council of Foreign Relations runs regular polls of public opinion on all sorts of things. And of course, in the several years following the end of the war, they had questions on the war. And one of the questions was, what do you think about the war? Over the years, between maybe two-thirds and 80% of the population said the war is not a mistake. It's fundamentally wrong and immoral. Mm. Try to find a phrase like that anywhere in educated intellectual commentary, except way out at the fringes. These are problems of American culture, very serious problems. We see them every day. It hasn't changed much since Vietnam. In other words, anything we do is at worst what Lewis said, blundering efforts to do good, no matter how horrendous it is. After the Second World War, there is no crime that begins to compare with the war in Indochina. Notice it's not just Vietnam. That's destruction of Laos. Cambodia was bombed more heavily than any country in history. It's a monstrous war, but it passes in history as blundering efforts to do good. In fact, a couple of years after the war, in 1977, President Carter had just been inaugurated. He had a news conference in which he was asked, should we offer some compensation for what we did in Vietnam, words like that. And he said, no, we shouldn't. He said, we owe them no debt because the destruction was mutual. Okay? 1977. You go on to, we'll skip Reagan, for whom it was a noble cause, and go on to George H.W. Bush, the statesman-like Bush. He approached the North Vietnamese, you know, the Hanoi government, and he said, look, we're a forgiving people. You know, we don't hold grudges. So we'd be willing to allow you to enter back into the world, you know, drop the sanctions and so on, but only if you devote your energies to dealing with the one moral problem that remains after the war, the bones of American pilots who you maliciously shot down. That's the one moral problem that remains after the worst crime in the post-war period. What's the worst crime in this millennium? The Iraq invasion. Nothing's even close. And we react the same way. That's a very serious problem about American culture. And the world knows it. There are international polls taken by the leading U.S. polling agencies, Gallup, which, among other things, ask which country is the greatest threat to world peace. The United States is first with no competitor. Way behind is Pakistan, probably inflated by the Indian vote. Americans are protected from that information. Press refused to publish it. A Gallup poll is not a secret. The BBC ran it.
I'm rereading your essays from the early, middle, and late 60s, Professor Chomsky, and the thread, if I can summarize a whole lot of work, is that Vietnam was a kind of liberal intellectuals' adventure. It was a social science field day for theories of nation building, economic development, in which immediately sort of pragmatic doubts arose about, is this working? Does this make any sense? But almost never a kind of moral question. Is that a fair summary of the way you see it now?
Exactly the same. To talk about the United States doing something morally wrong is kind of like talking Swahili. The words aren't English sentences.
We recognize by now something of a repetition compulsion syndrome after Vietnam. My question, and you're a student of the human mind, what is it? Is it in our water? Is it, as you say, the nature of power? Is it explainable that our policy learns so little in a way?
We can if we want. But we all know that it's just uncomfortable to look into the mirror and say, I'm a murderer. Suppose you're 6 years old and you have a three-year-old brother, and while your mother wasn't looking, you took a toy away from him. And he starts to cry, and your mother comes in What do you say?
He started it.
He started it, right. And it was really my toy, you know. And that goes up to John Stuart Mill and international affairs. It's, of course, it becomes really serious then. It's devastating for the world. But we didn't invent it. As for critical analysis, essentially none. I mean, the discussion is, did it work? If it didn't work, can we do it better? How about we don't have any right to do it? How about we don't have any right to decide we're going to attack another society because we think we can do something for it? How about that?
So what's your last word to a blundering do-gooder who has no idea of the destruction, death he's leaving in the wake?
Well, I would pick up about the signs of hope. The anti-war movement was strong enough to put some limits on the destruction of Indochina, and the countries at least survive. But it goes on from there. A couple of years later, Ronald Reagan comes in. 1981, take a look at what he did. The Reagan administration was planning to launch a major war in Central America, and they duplicated virtually point by point what their model, John F. Kennedy, had done in 1961. Same white paper, same cries about the Russians are coming, you know, the whole story. They had to back off because it immediately aroused large-scale protest from church groups, from activists and others. So within a couple of months, they backed off. There was never an invasion of Central America. It was bad enough, horrible, in fact. Hundreds of thousands of people killed, huge numbers tortured, orphans, countries destroyed, almost entirely by U.S.-backed forces. But it wasn't Vietnam. In 1961, there was no protest. So the thing escalated rapidly to the point where by 1967, when finally there was some protest, Bernard Fall, maybe the most credible commentator, wrote that he doubted that Vietnam could survive as a cultural and historical entity under the blows of the worst, most extreme attack by a military machine maybe in history. But it wasn't that bad in Central America. Well, let's move forward. The Iraq War. The Iraq War is the first time, I think, in the history of imperialism when there was massive protest before the war was officially launched. That's never happened before. It was horrible enough, as I described, but nothing like Vietnam. No carpet bombing by B-52s, no chemical warfare to destroy crops. Didn't get anywhere near the horrors of Vietnam. So yes, there's limited progress. I think there's a kind of a rise in the general level of civilization of the population. It's very hard to detect among educated sectors. They are usually the ones who lag farthest behind. And I think there's an understandable reason for that. Actually, it was kind of pointed out by George Orwell, as often is the case. He wrote an introduction to Animal Farm, which is not well known because it wasn't published. It was found later. But in it, he addressed to the people of England. This is, of course, about the totalitarian enemy. If you've had a good education, you have instilled into you the understanding that there are certain things it just wouldn't do to say, and I don't think he goes far enough. It wouldn't do to think them either. That's what a good education is. And if the more educated you are, the more likely you are to be deeply indoctrinated. And I think these things multiply.
That was the founder of modern linguistics and critic at large, Noam Chomsky. And what of the vast majority of Americans, the under 50s, who have no direct memory of Vietnam, the war, or the debates? Professor Stephen Beal teaches a seminar at Harvard on the Vietnam War in American culture. He says for his students, what leaps out from the official record in the Pentagon Papers is the calculation in a Defense Department memo from 1965 that 10% of the U.S. goal was helping the Vietnamese, 20% was warding off the power of China, 70% was avoiding a humiliating defeat. Stephen Beal told us this week that in the films and stories of the war, his students are always confronting other definitions of national shame.
It's been said that the Vietnam War was sort of suppressed or forgotten for a period of years after it ended. That's not really true if you think about it. Fall of Saigon is 75. The big three first Hollywood Vietnam films come out in 78 and 79. Coming Home first, then Deer Hunter, and then Apocalypse Now.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end.
In Apocalypse Now, there it's I find that students have a challenging time making a case for what the indictment of the war is in that film. The Martin Sheen character, Captain Willard, has been traumatized by the war. He's been sent to go after Kurtz, Marlon Brando, because Kurtz, according to the command, has crossed some sort of line, and the film asks us to really think about that. There's a line where the Martin Sheen character, Willard, says,
charging a man like murder in this place was like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500.
That is to say that the command has arbitrarily drawn a line and said that Kurtz, the Brando character, has crossed it, but the film also seems to be suggesting in some ways that the Kurtz character has taken the logic of American intervention to its conclusion. That is, he's become genocidal.
The horror. The horror.
What do you suppose, Steve Beal, is the cultural artifact that will live 100 years from now and say something about who we were in Vietnam?
I would say Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried.
Mm.
It's been a canonical text since it was published.
Why?
And it will stay so. I think in part because it resists an easy resolution to the war. And there are stories that are repeated, and the form of the book itself performs the trauma of the war. And it doesn't take a kind of easy, realistic form. It doesn't just tell a story of a soldier going to Vietnam and serving and being disillusioned and coming back. It doesn't give closure. It insists. It makes it a moral imperative that we continue to struggle with this and try to reckon with its meaning and not say, this is done, this is behind us. It doesn't want us to do that. It doesn't let us do that.
They carried all the emotional baggage of men who might die. Grief, terror, love, longing. These were intangibles, but the intangibles had their own mass and specific gravity. They had tangible weight. They carried shameful memories. They carried the common secret of cowardice barely restrained, the instinct to run or freeze or hide. And in many respects, this was the heaviest burden of all, for it could never be put down. It required perfect balance and perfect posture. They carried their reputations. They carried the soldier's greatest fear, which was the fear of blushing. Men killed and died because they were embarrassed not to.
That was the actor Bryan Cranston reading from the title story of Tim O'Brien's collection, The Things They Carried. Thank you, Christian Appy. Thank you, Noam Chomsky, Seymour Hersh, and Stephen Beal. Thanks also to Nguyen Ba Chung and Tom Herman, whose fine new documentary on the war's best reporters is called Dateline Saigon. We're going out on the song Cortez the Killer by Neil Young from 1975. There are lots of ways to stay in touch with us. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, radioopensource.org. Make sure to subscribe to Open Source on iTunes, too. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno, with help from Rebecca Panovka. Our engineers were Marquise Neal and George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.